And today we are going to do what we do just about every year, which is after the legislative session, we have a legislative wrap-up. I would like to introduce Linda Siegel, who has done the legislative update for the last couple of months during the session here in New Mexico. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you, Mary Charlotte. Glad to be here.
So the 2013 legislative session was a 60-day session. That's the long kind in which a lot of bills are discussed. Some are passed. Some percentage of those are signed. What was the sort of overall tone of the session this year? Did we get a lot of bills introduced and passed?
Well, as normal, at least for the last few 60-day sessions, we had about the same number of bills introduced, about a little over 1,600 bills. Memorials and constitutional amendments were introduced. And that, I went back and looked at 2011, 2009, and that's pretty much what has been done in the past. But years before that, we used to get 3,000 bills, memorials, constitutional amendments introduced. So it really has been reduced in the last few years because they've discouraged people from introducing the same bills in each chamber.
Ah, so people are supposed to introduce them in one, and if it passes that, then they get pushed over to the other.
Right, right. So you might have a senator and a House member co-sign a bill, but it would only be introduced in, like, the Senate. And then when it moved over into the House, that House member would carry it.
And did that actually help traffic problem?
Well, definitely, because as you can imagine, 3,000 bills, and they all have to go through the same process, which is generally two committee hearings in each chamber and then a floor session and then going to the governor. So many, many bills die, as now many bills die. In fact, out of that 1,656, only 298 were actually passed both chambers and sent to the governor.
So one thing that we had during this session was a lot of new members in the legislative bodies, the Senate and House of Representatives.
Yes, and this is the first time. I've been doing this since the 80s, and I cannot remember a time when we had more new people coming into the legislature. There are 112 legislators, 70 House members, 42 senators, and 33 of those, 29%, were brand new and many of them had never even stepped foot in the Capitol.
Interesting. So what was that like? I mean, obviously there's a learning curve for a lot of people. How did it affect the outcome?
A huge learning curve. And so what you would see in many of these hearings, where a lot of the members on a committee would be new, they weren't familiar with the process of how you ask questions, even though they did get some training. Particularly the House members got a lot more training, I think, than even the Senate did. But they have to become familiar with the type of questions that you normally ask and how you do it and how you vote, because there are many, you can vote for do pass, do not pass, table. There's all these maneuvers that can happen, and you got to know what the game is. And so to have that many new people with, like on the House Appropriations Committee, 7 people were brand new.
Oh my goodness.
And that makes for people who don't know the budget process even. And I think it made everybody's work a lot harder. You got these new people really trying hard to learn everything, and you've got the people that have been there trying to teach them while they're doing their work. So
I know, I was going to say, does everyone have their, like, mentor or big brother or big sister kind of thing?
Sometimes, yeah. Yeah, which is very helpful.
I have to say, when you talk about that, that's what the world would look like if people who wanted term limits got their way, because there would always be new people.
Right. And, you know, to some extent, I'm ambivalent about that, but there are advantages and disadvantages, because a lot of people that have been there for 30 years, maybe they aren't necessarily as enthusiastic or as attentive to a lot of the issues.
Exactly. So let's talk about some of the things that happened. The budget for the state did increase a little bit.
Yeah, when we started the legislative session, as we talked about before, it was projected that we had $283 million new dollars that we could spend on getting some of the programs and services that the state provides back up to the levels that they were in 2008. Because for the last 4 years, we've had dramatic decreases. Our budget in 2007 and 8 was $6.3 billion, and there was a dramatic cut in 9, and it went down to $5.4 billion. So now we're inching back up as the economy improved. But still, even though we thought we had 283 starting, we only had about 230 million in actuality. And that had to be distributed among all of the essential services that state government provides. And particularly, those are public education, higher education, Medicaid, and then you've got every other department, Department of Health, Department of Transportation, the health, the police, everything. So it's interesting to see in that budget that passed for $5.9 billion what the governor vetoed. Now, in past sessions, she's had a very heavy veto pen, and this year in the budget, she really hardly vetoed anything. Out of that $5.9 billion, she only vetoed $23 million, and $20 million of that was to go into the Higher Education Endowment Fund to replace money that we had taken out during the recession years. In actuality, then, she really only vetoed $3 million out of specific line items.
Interesting, which is it's a lot of money, but it's also a drop in the bucket of the
right.
whole budget.
Yes, absolutely. So people were pretty happy with how the budget came out in at least not having a whole lot of vetoes. There were some dissatisfaction, particularly from public education, about how the money got appropriated.
There were a few constitutional amendments, which will then... these were things that were
passed.
Already passed as constitutional amendments, but then the laws were put in place to reflect
right.
And flesh out.
Yes, those the things that people voted on in the 2012 general election, those big constitutional amendments around the Public Regulation Commission, the Public Defender's Office, and the Superintendent of Insurance becoming independent, all of those passed with the voters supporting them, and then the legislature had to develop a law to put them in place, and they did all of that. It was great.
So let's talk now about education. We still have a Secretary of Education who, I guess, still has not been confirmed?
Yes, that's an interesting process, because every secretary, health secretary, HSD secretary, education secretary, they have to be confirmed by the Senate, and they have to go through the Senate Rules Committee, where the committee has a hearing, takes testimony, asks lots of questions of the person, and then it goes to the whole Senate and they vote on it. Well, Hannah Scandera, who is the governor's choice to be the Secretary of Education, didn't even have a Rules Committee hearing for the last 2 years prior. And this year they finally did a Rules Committee hearing, and it was broken up into multiple committees. There was over 10 hours of testimony taken, and then they never voted. That means the secretary can continue to serve. She's the secretary designate. She's not the actual secretary. She continues to serve, but she's not been confirmed. And so that's how it is.
And so what, do we wait another year?
Well, I suspect that next year we'll go through a similar process, and maybe they'll vote. Maybe they won't. There's obviously there are politics involved in this one.
Really? I'm shocked. All right, so let's talk about some of the bills that were passed having to do with education.
Yeah, and you know, education... Obviously, it's so important, public education. And it takes up about 44% of our total state budget. The Education Department has gotten appropriated in this legislative session about $2.5 billion. Not only is the budget important and where the money goes in the budget, but then like a couple hundred bills related to education usually get introduced in a session like this, somehow related. So... some hot ones.
You know, before we talk about the hot ones, one of the things that people keep saying to me is, Mary Charlotte, explain to me the following. How is it that teachers are overworked and underpaid? There's no physical education in a lot of schools. There's no art supplies and music programs, and yet we spend billions. Where does it go?
Well, you know, we should have a show, and you can have the superintendent on to talk about this, because there is a specific funding formula, an amount of money that school districts receive for each child. I believe Santa Fe's is about $3,200-something. And actually, that amount per student depends on many factors in the funding formula. So some schools will get more money. The smaller schools, they get extra money because of being small. And it's, you know, we can, it's a very convoluted process. Every school district has its own board. They set their own rules and they try to provide the education. But in reality, the amount we spend per student is not that much. It's certainly not enough.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk about some of the specific legislation.
Okay, so a bill passed to require school boards and community college boards and other boards to give 72 hours notice for an agenda. It used to be you could just do an agenda in 24 hours, so that's a big change, and everyone will have to comply with that. School boards now have to pass cyberbullying policies. Every school district will have to do that. Campaign reporting now will be in effect for school districts and community colleges, but it only applies to school districts with 12,000 students or more. So really, that's Albuquerque, Santa Fe, Rio Rancho, and Doñana. But now people running for those offices will have to file campaign reports, and everybody who runs for community college board, like me, will have to file campaign reports.
Right.
One really good bill that passed, and it came about because a young woman who was in school in Hobbs got pregnant, and she had to be out of school to have the baby, and they threw her out of school because she was absent. So a bill passed to allow parenting teens to have a certain amount of time off to have the baby and to do parenting without being discharged
school.
From school. Yeah.
Now, is that one of those abstinence-only sex education districts?
I think it is. Guess it didn't work. And then, you know, loans for teachers in high-risk areas, that one passed, and some, a very important one. Several years ago, when we were still doing, having plenty of money, we passed a law that limited the classroom size and limited teaching loads and staffing patterns. Well, when we had the recession and we started cutting budgets, the schools couldn't meet those. So every year for the past several years, we've passed a bill that says, okay, we have to suspend those rules for one more year until we start getting the money back up to the levels it was. So that bill passed. And then there were some that were vetoed, the controversial ones that we've talked about over the last couple of years, like the teacher evaluation, because the governor and the administration, they have an idea about how teacher evaluations should be, and the legislators have another idea, and so the legislators passed a couple of bills on teacher and principal evaluations, and then the governor vetoed them. And the school A through F grading, there were two bills that passed on that, because what happened was Secretary Scandera just initiated the A through F evaluation without legislative approval. The legislators wanted it a different way, but that got vetoed too.
You know, it seems like, I mean, when people talk about the schools and everything, and teachers have a different point of view from legislators and from administrators, and I mean, what it boils down to is if you've got great teachers that are well-supported, well-trained, smart, innovative, creative, you should totally give them free rein and not evaluate them every 5 seconds and do all this standardized testing. If you've got terrible teachers,
right,
it's not, whatever you do isn't going to work.
Yeah.
And so you can evaluate and test until the cows come home, but if you don't have teachers who know, and it seems like in New Mexico, we've got a whole lot of both.
Right. Well, even yesterday on the news, they were talking about perhaps some scandal where teachers might have helped students with standardized test answers. And to rely, what part of what the legislature doesn't like is relying totally or heavily on standardized tests as a way to evaluate teachers, because we know that a lot of kids going to school have so many problems that have nothing to do with what they learn or don't learn in the schools.
We're talking to Linda Siegel and doing the legislative wrap-up. So we could talk about education for the next 24 hours, but let's move on. Pension reform was a big part of it, and something that if you're not in this in a state employee, you might not be paying attention to. But what happened?
Well, we have huge pension funds for both our state employees, which also includes county and city employees, and then we have our teacher retirement funds. The ERB is the teacher, the PERA is the state, county, etc. And both of those funds were insolvent in reality, that they only had 60% of their assets necessary to pay out. So we've been talking about this for several years. How are we going to get these funds up? How are we going to get these funds up? And finally, we got two bills this session, which in general, both sides had to give on, both the unions in both of the funds and the administration. And so what's going to happen is in ERB, there's going to be increases that the state will pay, or the public schools and the colleges and universities that are in ERB, and the employees will have to pay more. And it's going to be the same in PERA. The state will have to pay more, employees will have to pay more. And the COLAs, those cost of living increases, have been adjusted and reduced and will be more flexible now depending on how the economy is going. So we have gotten both funds up, I think, to about 90% based on the projections of these increases, and that is a good thing, because
good work.
All over the country, these pension funds are going under, and we don't want that to happen in New Mexico.
Very bad. ERB, by the way, what is it? Education Retirement
Board.
Board.
And the PERA, Public Employees Retirement Act or Agency or something. We just know the acronyms.
Para and ERB.
Yeah.
Well, good. Congratulations on that. Now let's move into health care.
Yes, a lot of bills introduced on health care. This is always the case. And probably for all of the people in New Mexico, and particularly those 400,000 people in our state who are uninsured, this is a very important bill, the Health Insurance Exchange. Because the federal law, the Patient Protection and Accountable Care Act, what people call Obamacare, it passed and it is in effect, and it told every state that you have to have your own health insurance exchange up and running and going and ready to take people by January 1, 2014, or you have to become part of the federal exchange. In New Mexico, we have always, the legislators and the advocates and even the insurance companies have always said we want our own exchange. But we've been trying to get our own exchange passed through the legislature for a couple of years, and there hasn't been agreement. Finally, again, this year, lots of compromise on both sides, and a health insurance exchange bill passed.
And as you have said in the past, nobody likes it, so it must be good.
Right, yes. And what it has are 13 members. Six are appointed by the governor, and six are appointed by different legislative groups. And the legislative people have already appointed theirs. And then one member is the superintendent of insurance, who now, because of the constitutional amendment and the law that passed, will be an independent superintendent of insurance.
Nice.
Also appointed by a committee, which will have members appointed by both the governor and the legislature. That is a good accomplishment, and now we're going to have to really work hard to get the systems in place so that people can start accessing the information by October of this year. It's going to be tough.
It's going to be tough, and it's going to be very interesting, because what we know is going to happen within less than a year is that there will be no more exclusion for people with so-called pre-existing conditions.
Absolutely.
And these health exchanges will be in place. And with any luck, a lot of people who haven't been insured and haven't been treated will be eligible for health insurance and indeed required to have health insurance.
Yes, there is the requirement that starts on January 1st that you must have health insurance. And of course, there will be the subsidy for people 400% of poverty and below. Buying insurance within the exchange, depending on their income level, will determine the size of the subsidy to help them pay those premiums.
Very interesting.
And then, of course, we have some other health care bills. One that I think is very important to consumers, which looked at the formulary change in your health insurance plan. A formulary are the list of drugs that that health insurer will pay for or will authorize. And some people with these policies were saying, well, I just found out that my drug's not going to be paid for anymore. Now I have to find something else, and I only got 30 days' notice. So a bill passed that would require insurance companies to give 120 days' notice to people if they're going to eliminate drugs from the formulary. And the governor actually signed that bill.
You know, why isn't it up to the doctors? Why is it up to the insurance companies what drugs a patient should be taking?
Well, when you're a prescriber, because you can be a nurse practitioner, a physician, others who prescribe medications, you actually have to go to the formulary of that insurance company and see if that drug is on it, because that's just the way we work in America. Mary Charlotte, is that a shock to you?
Yes, I am. I'm shocked. I'm shocked. Because, I mean, I'm basically healthy, so I haven't confronted all this stuff personally.
Right.
But basically, if your doctor says, this is the drug that's going to make you healthy, and your insurance company says, sorry, that's not on our formulary, you don't get that drug?
Right. Unless you go through the appeal process and say, well, this is the only drug that will help me. And you have to go through the bureaucracy then to try to get a drug that's not on the formulary.
I'm just going to say the following words. Single payer. Let's move on.
Okay. Another good bill, actually, that passed, which providers may not like, but it's mandatory immunization registry. And that will really help all the little kids that come to school and their parents go, well, I don't remember if they got this immunization or that one. And the school nurse is going, well, how am I going to do it? I'm going to have to give you another one. So everybody's got to put this in, theoretically, to one system, and then we'll be able to go in and check, oh, you did get this immunization. You don't need it again.
So otherwise, kids are getting immunized
twice. And then another good one, telemedicine insurance coverage. Because we're such a rural state, you might have a nurse practitioner out in a rural area who's providing primary care for someone, and she wants a specialist consult. So she's got her little telemedicine camera, and she hooks up to the one at UNM and talks to a physician, specialist, or whatever, and then, you know, decides what to do with her patient. Well, the insurance companies won't pay for that. So now, after this bill is passed and the governor has signed it, and when it goes into effect in June, then the insurance companies will have to pay for telemedicine consults. Because the option is drive that person into Albuquerque, see the specialist, and get the same result. So why not save everybody money?
Right. And some people don't have the ability to drive to Albuquerque.
Absolutely. So that's a really good thing. And, of course, we had our bills that dealt with the opioid crisis that we have. And there are lots. It's a huge problem, but it's very important that we don't restrict prescribers, from treating chronic pain patients. So it's got to be a real balancing act of how we address the crisis and the influx of opioids out on the street, which a lot of them aren't coming from providers, but coming from the black market.
Exactly.
And balancing that with providers being able to make sure they're taking care of their true chronic pain patients. So bills like that were introduced.
Right, because some, as we've talked about on this show before, some chronic pain patients have been denied pain medicine and suffer and actually die in excruciating pain because of laws that have been into place because of addicts who aren't them.
Right, and not necessarily in our state, but other places where they put these restrictions on.
Good, well, New Mexico is doing all right. So, shall we move on to social services?
Yes, of course, this is something near and dear to my heart because I work with a lot of these different providers. And to some extent, those groups were very successful in the legislature in getting more money in. Domestic violence is an example where in 2007 and 8, that there was $15 million going to the domestic violence programs throughout the state. And it got cut to $10 million. So they've been trying to get that money back up to the levels of the past. So this year they got 400,000. Sexual assault programs got 500,000. And there are always bills related to health and social services. This one is a good one, I think. Protective vests for police dogs. I put them in the social service arena. Another bill passed for...
Do a lot of dogs get shot?
Evidently, some dogs have been shot.
Oh, heavens.
Yeah, so they're going to be protected now.
Good.
Safe havens for infants. We passed this bill many years ago that said to a parent who had a baby, if they dropped the baby off at a hospital before it was 90 days old, 3 months old, that they could just give it and leave. Rather than, you know, putting it in a dumpster or doing things that had happened in the past. And I guess that's been working, but a bill was introduced, passed, and signed to allow people to drop the babies off at a fire station or a police station in addition to a hospital.
So if some 14-year-old had a baby, is unable to take care of it, has huge problems, they can drop their baby off and never see it again.
Right. Right. It's a tough thing, but it
saves lives.
There
are states where they passed that and they forgot to put age limits on the bill.
Oh,
and they were dropping
10-year-olds were getting dropped off.
Yes.
Yeah, that's why we say 90 days, three months. Another good bill that passed, amber alerts for people with dementia called silver alerts, because we do have amber alerts for kids if they go missing. Then immediately put the word out, the police are all watching for the kid. Well, sometimes people with dementia wander away, get lost, and there's no mechanism to alert everyone. This bill will enable that.
And that is so common.
It is. Yes, it
is. Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah.
People driving to to other states. I mean, I've seen this firsthand.
Yeah. It's scary. So now we do have a mechanism that everyone can know. And some, you know, one of the things that we've worked on in the domestic violence arena is trying to strengthen laws for abusers. And since strangulation is one of the most lethal and commonly used form of abuse in domestic violence situations, we've been trying to get for several years a specific definition of strangulation in the criminal code. And once again, that was introduced this year and didn't pass. And the
who could be against that?
Well, it's all about, in some people's minds, that we're creating more crimes and that we don't specifically need to say strangulation because we already have a crime against a battery, you know, touching somebody. But the domestic violence community feels like we do need to say strangulation is very lethal and it should be its own crime.
Okay.
And the same issue with the animal protection people who are always trying to... There's a very close connection between domestic violence and animal abuse.
Yeah.
And so I think we're going to be working with the animal protection people in the future. But they also have difficulty in getting bills passed to make abuse, I mean horrendous abuse of animals. I have to leave those hearings sometimes because they're so graphic about the terrible things that people do to animals, and oftentimes their bills don't pass either.
People who abuse animals also abuse other people.
Yes.
Studies have shown
a close correlation between the two.
Yeah.
So those are just some of the social service, health service, animal service bills that have passed.
Did any animal
pass
bills
or didn't pass?
Did any animal bills pass?
Well, one animal bill passed for the Assistance Animal Act changes, which added animals for emotional support. You know, blind people may have an animal, and those animals are always like seeing eye dogs, they call them. You'll see those signs on the door of a restaurant, right, or something. No animals except for assistance animals. Yeah, and but there are animals that help people emotionally that aren't necessarily, they may be even able-bodied people, but their animal is very, right, important and provides that emotional support. So that definition of emotional support was added, and miniature horses were added. So instead of having your animal assistance dog, you may have your animal assistance miniature horse now.
So you can bring your miniature horse into a movie theater?
Well, according to this law, that should be the same access as your animal assistance dog.
This is going to be interesting.
We'll see how that works.
We're talking to Linda Siegel with this year's legislative wrap-up. Now, we are in a climate change process. We are in a very serious drought process. And water was barely mentioned through the whole session.
It was pretty shocking. There were a handful of bills introduced related to water. I mean, as you said, here we are in the biggest drought in our history, probably. And we're kind of in denial. Peter Wirth had a bill to actually create and do a study of what we can do, and of course that didn't pass. The best I could tell, only one water bill passed, and that was to do a $37 million appropriation to buy water rights and to help people have funding to drill more wells. And it's just, it's a shocking omission,
yeah,
that we are in such denial that we're not even talking about what's going to be happening to us in the next few months with the,
yeah,
fires and the lack of water. On the news last night, Conscious Lake, which provides water to this town, they're worried that in a couple months, without a lot of rain, there's going to be no water for that town.
Sometimes I think we should have our legislative session in July. Because that's when it comes into our minds.
Yeah.
In the winter, sometimes it's snowing, people aren't thinking about it. Very,
yeah,
very scary.
Yeah. So that's something that didn't happen in the legislature, and it's, yeah, quite disappointing that we're not talking about it. And on that topic, what about the fireworks? There wasn't even a bill introduced this session to have the ability for counties to say, no, you cannot sell fireworks. We've tried those bills in the past. They always get killed in the committee, and I guess we just didn't do it. Our state can be burning up in the next few months, and local government should have the right to say, you cannot sell fireworks. I'm sorry if it's your business and profession. Our forests mean more than that.
Right. All right, so let's talk about the spaceport.
Yes, that was a bill that was anxiously awaited. You know, we've invested about $209 million of our taxpayer dollars in that spaceport, and it was in jeopardy unless we passed this liability bill to limit the liability of the equipment suppliers. We had limited the liability of the spaceships or whatever, the people flying them. But a lot of the companies were saying, okay, well, you know, we're not coming to New Mexico if you don't limit the liability of the equipment makers, the people the equipment that's on those, that are those spaceships, whatever they're called.
So if they supply faulty O-rings, it's just tough luck.
Well, they'll have some limited liability, yes, indeed.
All right. Well, as we talked about on my April Fool's Day show, which nobody seemed to get, you're going to be able to parachute out of space shuttles. No. Anyway. all right. What else? Taxation.
I think we mentioned this a little bit at my last wrap-up, and it was this omnibus tax bill that passed in the late hours on Friday night and then passed out of committee, Senate committee, and then got on the floor of the Senate and amended into another bill, which then went over to the House at 11:30. Remember, we adjourn at 12. And nobody in either chamber, or very few people in either chamber, had seen this tax bill. It was a multiple issue tax bill. Depending on your perspective, it had good and bad things in it, but the thing that it had in it, which has been most problematic to the cities and the counties, is it took away their hold harmless on medical and food tax. You'll remember in 2003, the legislature and the governor passed and the governor signed elimination of food tax, elimination of certain medical taxes, gross receipts taxes across the board. But in order to get the cities and the counties to go along with it, the state would pay them the portion that they were going to lose. And this bill took that away with no discussion whatsoever. So it's a process issue which many legislators in both chambers are upset about, because particularly in the House, they had no discussion on it whatsoever. They just had to vote up or down. And right. And some of our delegation here voted against it because they felt like, well, I don't know what's in this bill. How can I possibly vote for it?
Right. And process, and next session, maybe we'll do a show just on process, because we always talk about what happened in the session and what's happening in the session. But a lot of what determines what happens and doesn't happen is these processes that nobody outside the legislature even knows about, and they're really important.
Yes, yes. And when they're ignored, the typical processes that are ignored, many of the legislators get upset, as they should.
Well, it's just about time to wrap up. Let's just go through very quickly through things that were vetoed and things that weren't passed at all. We got no gun control. We got no lowering of marijuana penalties.
We fortunately got no driver's license repeals. One thing that wasn't passed, which the governor really wanted, was the Navajo gaming compacts to be approved. So those are going to have to wait till the 2014 session. And, of course, we have gaming compacts with every other pueblo that has gaming. And then those that were vetoed, minimum wage, $8.50 for the state. The governor supported a $7.80 minimum wage, but that's not what passed, and she vetoed the $8.50 minimum wage.
Aye, aye, aye.
Disclosure of campaign contributions, political campaign contributions by people that contract with the state. The legislature passed a bill, wanted that on the Sunshine Portal, but she vetoed that.
Oh, the Transparency Administration. Right.
Yes.
Okay.
The public campaign financing changes. The Supreme Court in New Mexico ruled that the way we were doing our public finances, public campaign finance for the judges, wasn't constitutional. So this was a way to fix that, and that was vetoed.
Linda Siegel is a lobbyist. She does the legislative update with us every year. We're going on, I don't even know how many years now. And this has been the legislative wrap-up. As always, it's a great pleasure to talk to you, Linda Siegel. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
I'd like now to welcome Fran Hardy. She's producer of the documentary film The Earth Chronicles Project, The Artist Process, New Mexico, which screens tonight at the Santa Fe Art Institute. And she's curator of the accompanying exhibition that will be at the Santa Fe Art Institute through the 17th of May. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. Great to be here.
So you basically, Earth Chronicles, you are working with and documenting artists who are in some way engaging with the earth locally.
Yes, and actually not just artists. We interview all kinds of passionate individuals. The exhibition is, of course, made up of the artists that we interview in the documentary, but we also interview different people that work with ecology and culture
right.
in the state of New Mexico and its connection to art.
Now, this is one in a series of Earth Chronicles projects that you have done.
Yes, we're doing them all over the country. As we raise money in a different region, then we go to that region. We get sponsorship from museums and private donations, grants, etc.
And what's the sort of overall vision of this?
Well, the vision is that we want to show passionate individuals who are using art, ecological sustainability, and cultural preservation to keep what's important about their state alive. And we feel that all three of these are intricately connected, and without one, you can't have the other. And we want to inspire people to realize that in their own little sphere of influence, that they can find something they're passionate about that can make a difference. I feel like there's just such a barrage of bad news all the time that I know I feel overwhelmed, and I feel like I can't do, can I do anything to make a difference? So we're trying to show people that they can.
And you're working against federal bureaucracy that's really hard to work with, and fossil fuel lobbies and subsidies and all of these things. And the reality is, or the possible reality is, that individuals and small groups working all over the country are doing things that agencies, big agencies and governments cannot do.
Yes, and on that small scale, they can actually get something done in their region and feel like something can be achieved. Yeah, and if they're not dealing with all the bureaucracy, they're finding ways, and we really want to show people that there are ways and be inspired to find their way creatively.
So how did you start your process of gathering people together to make this film in New Mexico?
Okay, well, I always sit down for at least 2 to 3 months before we're even going to go into production on the documentary. First, I look at fundraising. Can we find supporters for the region that we're in? We start with South Florida. We had support through National Endowment for the Arts, Florida Division of Cultural Affairs, Florida Arts Council, and the Foosner Art Museum to do it there. In Oklahoma, we had the support of the Mabee Guerra Museum of Art, who was our sponsor. And then here, we got a grant from New Mexico Arts Council, NEA, and New Mexico Division of Cultural Affairs. So they were our sponsors, and also private donations. It's always, fundraising is always the big challenge.
But and then?
Then I sit down, once I feel that we can do this in this region, and we'll have sufficient funds, I sit down and I do a lot of research, just like I'm sure you do for your program, on who and what is happening in that region and what really excites me. So it's great for me because it gives me a chance to curate and pursue what I'm passionate about in this area. And I'm also an environmental artist, so my work is also included in one way or another in the program. But we go all over, in New Mexico, for instance, all over the state. We've worked a lot with the Nature Conservancy because we really like their projects across the country. So the Gila and Mimbres Preserve will be featured in this one. And then I look for artists that I think are doing exciting things for the environment and talking about the environment in New Mexico. So we've got quite a long roster of artists and other people involved in art, ecology, and culture across the state of New Mexico.
And KSFR's own Lauren Camp is one of them.
She is, yes. Lauren's wonderful.
Artist.
Yes. So, and Lauren is so diverse. I mean, not only does she do audio saucepan, but her fiber art is fabulous. And we chose, of course, pieces that speak to the environment in New Mexico primarily, and some to the culture in her work. And also, of course, her poetry. And she'll be doing a poetry workshop as one of our activities that goes along with the project.
Right, right. And now there are also people in the film who are not artists. You've got somebody who is an ecologist talking about the Gila River and beautiful footage down there.
Right, yes. I think she's considered the southern or southwestern or southeastern director of the New Mexico Nature Conservancy. And they put us up down at the Gila Riparian Preserve. And she took us around to both the Gila and the Mimbres Rivers and showed us what they're doing there to try and preserve watersheds, which, of course, is such a huge issue in New Mexico, water, obviously. We have Judith Phillips, who's written, many people will know her name because she was one of the pioneers of writing about drought tolerance in the Southwest,
right,
and xeriscaping, and we're interviewing her. Because, of course, water is a huge issue for the state.
And then you've got somebody from the Valles Caldera, and it's...
Yes.
It was a very sweet segment in the film where basically talking about building visitor centers and campsites and things to make it accessible to the public. And I was watching this and just thinking it really takes all kinds of passionate people working in every walk of life to make the world go round.
Absolutely.
And these people are unsung people.
Yes. Yeah, and what we found by doing this, because Catherine Harris also, who works at University of New Mexico, is a landscape architect, is that landscape architects, which is what Rourke at Valles Caldera is, have a lot of diverse things to do with, as you're saying, about ecology in a region and in the parks, et cetera. But I didn't realize that parks had landscape architects.
Right.
So, yeah.
We're talking about the Earth Chronicles project. Now, the film and the exhibition go together. The exhibition, which is just opening today at the Santa Fe Art Institute, so the artists featured in the film will be exhibiting their work there, or you have curated it and are putting their work up at the Institute.
Right. It's a wonderful opportunity as an artist to be able to curate also, because a lot of times we're on the other end of the spectrum, so I get to do both. I put both my work in and then the work of other environmental artists that we've interviewed in the documentary. So basically, this exhibition is unique in that it's driven by a documentary. The documentary inspires the exhibition. So people will come in and see a very eclectic mix of work, but that's the linkage, is that it's all inspired by the interviews that we did in the documentary.
And you have fiber arts and glass arts and all kinds of things that are somewhere in that supposed, I don't even believe in these categories, but arts and crafts.
Right.
You know, kind of spanning all those areas.
Yeah, I don't believe in the categories either. Someone that was there doing a residency questioned that, and I feel like it's all art. If you go back to some of the primitive art, say from Nigeria or something, to me it's some of the finest art that's ever been done in the world. And Stacy Neff and the New Mexico Experimental Glass Workshop were included because they were, not only is the work wonderful and innovative, but they work strictly with recycled glass.
Yeah. Very interesting. So that's, again, part of the earth-friendly feature of your work. Tell us about your own work.
Well, my own work, my passion is ancient trees and native plants. I've seen so many places where the native is getting crowded out by non-native, and of course with water being an issue and just preserving the environment, I've been very disturbed by that. So that's my focus, and I happen to just adore ancient trees and forests. So being that I get to be the curator and the creator of where we go in this documentary, I always try to pick important places where there are ancient trees.
And what is the medium in which you work?
Well, I've worked in a variety of mediums. In this show, we don't have any of my oil over egg tempera work. They're all works on panel. There's colored pencil on acrylic ground on panel and graphite on panel.
So this film will be shown tonight. For people who don't come tonight, will they have an opportunity to see it at the exhibition at all? Or?
Yes, they will. It's actually our documentary process, because we've been working on this for over a year, and it'll probably be two and a half years before we feel like it's broadcast ready. So thus far, all of our documentaries have aired on PBS stations and FEC TV and at museums. So we have to get them to PBS length and all of that. So people are getting to see an intimate look into our process of building this documentary. So parts of it are extremely polished, and other parts we're still putting together.
Right.
But yes, there will be, not only will they be able to come and see it tonight, but there'll be a special screening for the New Mexico Nature Conservancy, because they're all excited about it. So there will be another opportunity. But they can also come to a viewing room in the exhibition space, where there'll be some chairs and they can sit and watch the documentary when they come to see the exhibit. So if they can't make it to the opening and the screening, they can sit and watch it in a smaller space.
Okay.
Yeah.
And eventually we will look forward to seeing this on PBS.
Yes. They've always have before, so I would suspect that this time, but we get them finished and then we present them to the PBS stations. So, yeah.
Excellent.
I would hope that it would air in New Mexico. Yeah.
Fran Hardy is producer of the documentary film Earth Chronicles Project, The Artist Process New Mexico, which is screening tonight at 6 o'clock at the Santa Fe Art Institute. And she's curator of the exhibition that will also be at the Art Institute until the 17th of May. For more information, you can go to earthchroniclesproject.com. Fran, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Okay.